by the Lord. In fact, so far as a specific command to do this, it is the only act of worship that He specifically commanded. We learn about other acts of worship from seeing what He Himself engaged in, such as praying and singing, and then from the apostles' directions and so on. In Acts 20 and verse 7, the very purpose of the assembly on the first day of the week was to partake of that supper, because it is said that upon the first day of the week, when the disciples gathered together to break bread, that's why they gathered together. One of the questions about the Lord's Supper that has been raised of late is whether the Lord's Supper is to be eaten more or less as a meal, either with just plenty of food of all kinds to eat, in addition to the unleavened bread and fruit of the vine, or whether the unleavened bread and the fruit of the vine themselves are to be eaten in quantities such as to make a meal, having baskets of unleavened bread and pitchers of grape juice. I want to address this question. In the Bible, the Lord's Supper was instituted during the Passover feast, Matthew 26, Mark 14, Luke 22. In a rabbinical description of the feast, such as it would have been engaged in at that time, we find that, first of all, there was a cup that was taken, and it's just called the first cup with its blessing, and there were bitter herbs to recall the bitter life in Egypt, unleavened bread, and then there was a dip that was called a kasaret, the roasted lamb, and then additional food called the kagiga. As the ceremonies begin, the house father, the father of the family, or the father, sometimes there was more than one family that might be together, but the house father dips the bitter herbs into the kasaret with a benediction or a blessing, and then eats, and the others follow. Then the second cup is drunk. It is mixed, wine with water. The first part of the Hallel is sung, Psalms 113 and 114. With a prayer of praise, then the second cup, which has been prepared, is drunk. The father then washes his hands, takes two cakes of bread. He breaks one and puts the broken one on top of the unbroken one, blesses the bread out of the earth, wraps a broken piece of that bread with herbs, dips it into the kasaret, eats it along with a piece of the kagiga and a piece of the lamb. At that point, everyone joins in the eating of the Passover. When that is finished, the father eats the last morsel of lamb, and a third cup is drunk. The second part of the Hallel is sung by the group, Psalms 115 through 118, and then a fourth cup, sometimes even a fifth one, and then the conclusion of the Hallel is sung. We find the expression in Matthew 26 and Mark 14, "And as they were eating," we find that expression in both those references, Matthew 26, 21, and Mark 14, 22. That refers to the point made when everyone joins in the eating. Everyone was eating together. At the end of that period, but before the conclusion of the feast, before the father ate the last morsel of lamb, and before the third cup, Jesus, likely at that point, took the unleavened bread and appointed it as a symbol of his body. Now, at this point, it is important to know that what they were engaged in here was the eating of the Passover meal. And the Passover meal was a feast that was ordained by God. It was a feast. It was a memorial, but it was a feast with meat and bread and drink and bitter herbs and so on. So it was designed by God to be a full meal. And so as they were eating, Jesus took the element of unleavened bread, which was merely one of the things present in this meal, and he also, then a little bit later, took the fruit of the vine. By the way, it is important to note that there is no reference in any passage that says wine in the Lord's Supper, in connection with the Lord's Supper. In every reference connected specifically with the Lord's Supper, the expression is fruit of the vine. And even if it were wine, the Greek word that is most commonly translated wine is a word that signified grape juice without necessarily indicating what level of fermentation there was with it, and also mixed with water. I've presented lessons here on at least two occasions, setting forth information that we can find that helps us to understand that. But as a matter of fact, there is no verse that specifically mentions the Lord's Supper that uses the word wine. Then Jesus, after the supper, now this is according to Luke's account, after the supper, he took a cup and appointed it the symbol of his blood, Luke 22 and verse 20. So what happened was, during this full meal, Jesus took two elements. Now notice, he didn't say, I want you to keep this meal as a memorial of me. Now how easy that would have been for him to do. As they were eating the Passover, he could have just said, now what I want you to do is go on observing this meal as a memorial to me, since I am now your Passover. I am the new Passover lamb. So I want you to eat this. He did not say that. He absolutely did not say that. He took two and only two elements from that feast. One was unleavened bread, and the other was fruit of the vine. Now, whereas the Passover was an actual meal with a considerable amount of food consumed and grape juice drunk, the Lord's Supper was strictly a memorial, and there was nothing commanded to make it a meal. The Lord, when he said these things, he merely used the Passover meal as the occasion, to command the observance of a totally different thing. The Lord's Supper is not the Passover. The only thing it has to do with the Passover is that it was the Passover meal they were engaged in eating when the Lord took two of the elements of that Passover supper and ordained them as the elements that would represent His body and His blood in the years to come. He commanded that it be done in remembrance, Luke 22:19, and also in 1 Corinthians 11, verses 24 and 25. Now, when he said this, he did not mean that now they were to set in and eat several stacks of unleavened bread and drink several more cups. In other words, this was being commanded for the future. He ate the Passover with them there, but he commanded that the Lord's Supper be observed in the future. They did not set in here then and observe the Lord's Supper, but he was commanding that the Lord's Supper be observed by those who would come after his death and resurrection. That's when it would be observed. Turn to 1 Corinthians 11 for a little bit here. Making the Lord's Supper into a meal would tend by design to create the problems that Paul dealt with in this chapter. Now, it's one thing for things to sort of evolve and happen, and you get into some bad habits doing some things that lead to some abuses and problems. It is another to do it by design. And to say that we're going to take the memorial supper, the Lord's Supper, and make it into a full meal would be to tend to create the problems that Paul dealt with in this chapter. In chapter 11 and verse 21, he says, let's begin in verse 20. When therefore ye assemble yourselves together, it is not possible to eat the Lord's Supper. For in your eating, each one taketh before other his own supper, and one is hungry, and another is drunken. So a distinction is made in that verse between the Lord's Supper and each one taking his own supper. In the context, he points out that feasting should be done at home. Eating to satisfy hunger should be done at home. That's why he says, what? Have you not houses to eat and to drink in? The point is, here you have come together and you're acting like you've never had a meal before. Don't you have houses to eat and drink in? The Lord's Supper should not be eaten as a common meal. It is not designed to be a common meal. It is uncertain in the minds of students of this passage whether this was a combination of the so-called agape, or love feast, with the Lord's Supper, or whether it was the Lord's Supper itself turned into a meal. And you can read both ways. In either case, however, Paul did not consider what they were doing here a good thing, and reprimanded them rather severely because of the abuses that they were practicing in connection with the Lord's Supper. His comments on the bread and the cup here are to remind us of its special significance. And his points are that by observing the supper, we are proclaiming the Lord's death till He comes. We are remembering what He did, and we are proclaiming His death until He comes. Look in verse 29. Verse 28 and 29. But let a man prove himself, examine himself, and so, meaning in this manner, let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For he that eateth and drinketh judgment unto himself, if he discern not the body. I consider this to be a most grave warning. And let me just suggest something. If you are eating the bread that signifies the Lord's body, and you take a piece of it and you eat it, and that's the bread that you're eating to remind you of the Lord's body, what happens to you if you tend to eat something over a fairly prolonged period? Well, I'll tell you what happens. Your ability to keep your mind on what you're doing is gravely compromised. Sometimes I have enough trouble as it is remembering what I'm supposed to do when the unleavened bread is passed and when it's time to drink the fruit of the vine. If I were sitting there for 30 minutes eating away and eating away and eating away, I wouldn't be near as likely to be able to keep my mind concentrated on the fact that this bread is representing the Lord's body. A little bit more about that in just a moment. All of the dangers that are warned against in this passage would be greatly increased if the Lord's Supper were consumed in the manner of a normal meal, either by adding other foods to be consumed in addition to the unleavened bread and fruit of the vine, or whether we just take the Lord's Supper itself, the bread and the fruit of the vine, and eat enough of that for it to be a meal. In his book, Radical Restoration, Legard Smith unabashedly advocates having a full meal with meat, vegetables, the whole bit, and whatever else one might eat at a social meal, and just making that sort of in connection with the Lord's Supper. There are those in this county who are following the lead of Legard Smith, and they're doing exactly what he is advocating. They are eating sufficient quantities of the unleavened bread and fruit of the vine to make it into a common meal. Now then, back to that point I was making a while ago in view of what we're supposed to be thinking about when we are observing this memorial supper. I want you to think for a moment of the thought process that would go into consuming large amounts of bread and fruit of the vine. In other words, if I eat more than just a small quantity, what am I eating it for? The thought process would go something like this. That piece of unleavened bread representing the body of Christ that I just ate was certainly good. It was so crisp and flaky, and in fact, it was so good, I believe I'm going to have another one. Boy, was that good. I'm still hungry. I believe I will have another one. Now, if you weren't thinking those thoughts, why would you be taking another one and another one? It appears to me that it would be inescapable that the mere matter of hunger would be entering into this, and how good this is, and how flaky this is. And this is unusually good unleavened bread. This is better unleavened bread than last week's unleavened bread was. And I'm going to eat more this time. You couldn't avoid doing that. And that's one of the big reasons why I say that it is not meant by the Lord to be taken as a full meal. Or you're drinking grape juice and you say, "Oh, this grape juice is certainly refreshing. I was getting really dry here, and so I'm glad to be able to drink this grape juice, so cool and sweet. In fact, I think I'll pour myself another glass." Again, it's the matter of how this tastes, how I like this, how I like the unleavened bread, how I like the fruit of the vine. Well, it is a fact. I do enjoy unleavened bread. I enjoy the taste of it. Most pie crusts are basically unleavened bread, and I sure like them. And yeah, I like grape juice. But I don't want to be involved in a meal where my attention is going to be focused on just eating it, because that's going to make it that much harder to keep my mind on what I'm doing and what I'm supposed to be remembering. And in the reasoning that we've looked at here, the motive for having more has nothing to do with remembering the death of Jesus. How much of it would you have to eat to remember the death of Jesus? So if you eat more than that, what are you eating it for? Because it tastes good. And thus we merge into a common meal. And we forget. The whole thing that Paul was dealing with here was, don't forget what you're doing. And when you come together, it's not possible to eat the Lord's Supper. Because in your eating, each one taketh before other his own supper, and one is hungry and another is drunken. Don't you have houses to eat and drink in? Or despise ye the church of God and put them to shame that have not? Now, in any kind of a discussion such as this, one of the things that you have to be careful about is not taking what amounts to a ridiculous position. I don't want to take a ridiculous position of telling you that I know exactly how big a piece of bread you're supposed to eat. I can't tell you how big a piece of bread to eat. Nobody can, for the simple reason that Jesus did not say anything about how big a piece of bread should be eaten or exactly how much fruit of the vine should be drunk. I am not trying to say, and I'm not going to try to say, how big or how much, since we have no details on the matter. Many of those who contend for the position we're talking about here say that at their services they don't require a person to take a large piece, that you can just take a piece of it, a small piece of it if you want. Then why start the church? Why start that church? I do think that taking the position that it must be eaten as a meal to the point of starting a new congregation is to take a pretty strong position on that. And it makes the strong implication that those who don't do it that way are wrong. Now, you figure it otherwise. If it is not wrong to do it the way we generally do it, why do you have to start a new church to do it the new way? Why? I want to give you some quotations about the agape or love feast. And that is really what most of this amounts to. And in what Lagarde Smith has done, it is just an attempt to revive the old agape. So I have some quotations and some comments of my own to make about the agape. First of all, the so-called agape. By the way, agape is the Greek word for love. It's just the Greek word for love. The agape was not commanded by Jesus or by any apostle. That is a fact to be noted carefully. The agape was not commanded by Jesus or by the apostles. From the evidence that we have, it seems to have been practiced by the brethren of ancient times in an attempt to recreate the setting in which the Lord's Supper was instituted. But I want to point out to you that Jesus never said, recreate the situation in which the Lord's Supper was instituted. He never said recreate the situation. So that when men are doing that, that's their own idea, their own thinking. It was never commanded by Jesus or the apostles. And little is said of the feast in the New Testament. Back during the 50s and the 60s, in the battle over institutionalism, the love feast was occasionally highly touted as an example of the kind of things brethren were wanting to do with their kitchens and fellowship halls. And so you would build a $50,000 kitchen and build and equip a very correspondingly expensive dining room so that all the members could get together and feast. And this was a love feast, or so it was claimed. The word agape is found in the New Testament 116 times. Do you want to know how many times you find it translated as love feast? Because to listen to people who talk about the agape or the love feast, you'd think that it fairly drips from the pages of the New Testament. 1 time. Out of the 116. And that is in the book of Jude, verse 12, where Jude is talking about the hypocrisy of some who participate in that love feast, the false teachers that Peter also condemned in 2 Peter chapter 2. These are they who are hidden rocks in your love feast. And that is the only reference to love feast in the New Testament. Brethren ate together in the New Testament. We can find a number of references where they ate together in the New Testament, but there's only one mention of this love feast. I quote from Albert Barnes, a noted Presbyterian commentator who lived in the 1800s. He said, "Besides, I know not that there is the slightest evidence, as has been often supposed, that the observance of the Lord's Supper was preceded in the times of the apostles by such a festival as a love feast. I know not that there is the slightest evidence, as has been often supposed, that the observance of the Lord's Supper was preceded in the times of the apostles by such a festival as a love feast. In their article on agape, McClinock and Strong tell us a lot about the love feasts, mostly by giving their inferences and the inferences of Mosheim and Neander and other church historians. But they also say, though the agape usually succeeded the Eucharist, which they used to talk about the Lord's Supper, though the agape usually succeeded the Eucharist, yet they are not alluded to in Justin Martyr's description of the latter. When Justin Martyr wrote of the Lord's Supper, he did not allude to the agape. While Tertullian, on the contrary, in his account of the agape, makes no distinct mention of the Eucharist. And then they quote from him. "The nature of our supper," he says, "may be gathered from its name, which is the Greek term for love." Tertullian wrote in Latin. So he was explaining that the nature of our supper may be gathered from its name, which is the Greek term for love. "However much it may cost us, it is real gain to incur such expense in the cause of piety, for we aid the poor by this refreshment." I'm stopping the reading for a moment to make the point that in a lot of the really old writings, when you talk about, when they mention anything about agape and the church fathers, it very often is mentioned in connection with relieving the poor. And so I've wondered through the years, when all of the churches with their big kitchens and dining rooms and everything have their agapes, I wonder how many of the poor are invited there. "We do not sit down to it till we have first tasted of prayer to God. We eat to satisfy our hunger. We drink no more than befits the temperate. We feast as those who recollect that they are to spend the night in devotion. We converse as those who know that the Lord is an ear witness. After water for washing hands and lights have been brought in, everyone is required to sing something to the praise of God, either from the Scriptures or from his own thoughts. By this means, if anyone has indulged in excess, he is detected. Because you see, as you indulge, you might get to the point where you couldn't remember a song very well. So we have them do that to let them, so we can detect if they, the feast is closed with prayer. Does that sound like something you would want to be at? Frederick Godet lived from 1812 to 1900. He believed that the church practiced a love feast concluded by the Lord's Supper. But he provides us with the information that, quote, at length the meal itself was totally abolished. And he means the agape. This abolishment was almost certainly because of the abuses that kept occurring in connection with the feast. And he also makes this comment on 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 21. By the way in which they act, they change the sacred feast into an ordinary supper. I think his words here are very appropriate. Listen again. By the way in which they act, they change the sacred feast into an ordinary supper, which has no longer anything in common with the sacred feast which it should recall. Also in verse 22, he says, Paul points out three principal sins in this conduct. First, the feast itself so celebrated, the agape with the Holy Supper terminating it, is not a meal taken for support. It is a religious rite expressly instituted, and that for a religious purpose. That's exactly right. Right on. Say that again. It is not a meal taken for support. It is a religious rite expressly instituted, and that for a religious purpose. But it was not the agape that Jesus instituted. It was the Lord's Supper, consisting of two items: unleavened bread and fruit of the vine. In Lagarde's book, he provides no reference to any scriptural instruction to partake of a common meal in connection with the Lord's Supper. And the reason why is there isn't one. I want to speak plainly to you. This is a danger. We are living in a day which emphasizes feelings rather than facts. Now, I would not like to be a person who lived only with facts and no feelings, but I certainly do not intend to be a person who lets my feelings guide me in what I believe is right. And this is such a danger. And we begin to define things like piety and holiness in terms of feelings. Piety. What is piety? That is the feeling that you get when you're sitting with a group of people that you think a lot of, with the lights dim, you're holding hands and you're singing songs of praise and harmony, and you know that really great feeling you have inside? That's piety. No, no, no. And yet again, no. That is not piety. What's holiness? Holiness is a warm, fuzzy feeling toward God, regardless of what you do, teach, say, practice. No, that is not what holiness is. And it is assumptions and ideas like that that lie behind so much of this. And when I read books such as Lagarde's and other books that have been written by other people of his kind, I am appalled at how much they know about how formal you and I are being when we come together and observe the Lord's Supper. It is amazing how much they know about how little we're thinking about what we're doing, and how poorly we observe the Lord's Supper, and how poorly we worship God, and how poorly we sing, and how poorly we do everything we do. And I say, it is not their ability to know what I am feeling when I'm singing, and what I am feeling, and what you're feeling when we're doing what we're doing. And so there are people who have the feeling that, you know, I just don't feel like I'm really into this as much as I ought to be, and I would like to get the feeling better. Well, his book is an effort to restore inward holiness by outward arrangements in which there is a greater feeling of fuzzy warmth inside. And it is so much fun if you can be with people that you've had differences with, and you can kind of put aside the differences and feel like, hey, you know, there's no conflict between us. That makes me feel so good, I think I'll give you a hug. What does that do about truth? What does that have to do about what is really the facts? If truth is the issue, then merely creating circumstance in which we feel really nice and good toward one another, that does not remove the barrier. That does not solve the problem. And such things, as he discusses, have no inherent connection with assuring holiness and zeal. And some of his ideas are just plain wrong. I talked with Lois Lee a few weeks ago, and he had preached a couple of sermons dealing with Lagarde's book. And I was talking with a lady that attended the church there and had heard the sermons, and she said that when Lowell presented the lessons, he said, basically, "And I fervently hope you won't read the book." Well, I'm going to say also, I fervently hope you won't run out and get it and read it. I'm not a censor. If you want to get it, you can read it. But when you do, you exercise care, and you think, because one of the things that he does as a master is he asks questions and picks at spots and gets questions planted in the mind. And if you've ever had a day when you felt like, well, you know, I don't know if I really entered into the worship today like I ought to have, maybe it would help me if I did something. No, that's not what's going to help you. That's not what's going to help you. This matter of holiness, this matter of worship, the matter of piety, the matter of our relationship to God does not depend upon external circumstances. And that's one of my greatest objections to this movement, this idea, and similar things, is that there is an effort to create holiness and piety and this really great relationship with God through purely external circumstances. Having a smaller group and doing things like that, you know, and just physical arrangements of the way things are done. No, that is not what determines it. Through the years, I have worshipped in about as many different circumstances as probably most anybody else has worshipped. And today, when I go to a very small place to preach, I don't have a bit of trouble in the world doing that, because that's how I cut my teeth on preaching, to a handful. I preach to a handful. For years and years and years, I preached to little handfuls. And I learned how to do that. And I enjoyed being with those handfuls. And sometimes it was possible to have a very warm relationship, but then other times it was dead as a doornail. Deader than a doornail. Some of those little groups that I was with, they were strong and grew and were vibrant, full of life. Imperfect people striving together. and others of them were small and dead, dead, dead. So smallness is no necessary key to spiritual closeness with one another. I know. I've been there. When I came to Eastside was the only large church that I have ever worked with. But when I came to Eastside, one of the first services, I remember sitting up here somewhere, probably about where we are now. I remember sitting there and hearing the singing. And we were not used to a large number of people singing together. And that was almost exactly 10 years ago. And I remember to this day what it made me feel like. It made me feel really good. Even brought tears to my eyes. It was such an experience. Was it therefore holy? You know, something that moves me is not necessarily something that moves God. But really the point I mention that for is that here in a large group, I could have some of the most intense religious feelings that I've ever had. And I have never been to a church that I enjoyed preaching at more than this one. And I know that holiness and righteousness and piety do not depend upon whether it's a big one or a little one. One of the biggest differences between a big one and a little one is that with a little one, you're always wondering, how are we going to afford that? Where are we going to get material from? How are we going to support the preaching of the gospel? We ought not to disregard the tremendous advantages and blessings that God has given us, because there are times we have dissatisfaction with the way we feel when we come out of worship. I say unto you again, the idea of worshiping God is something that is done internally. Oh yeah, there are externals also. But it is in your heart and in my heart. That's where we relate to God. That's where we draw nigh unto God. That's how we determine whether our worship is acceptable unto God. But let us appreciate the blessings that we have as a congregation. And really, if there were just one thing that I would try to impress upon you as we end our study tonight, it would be to repeat this idea, because it is such a problem today, to repeat the idea that we cannot bring about true holiness within by just the logistics, by the external circumstances of our meeting. It is interesting to read in the Bible, throughout the whole Bible, when Israel gathered together every seventh year, when the law was read to the assembled Israel, how many of them were there? Who could count how many thousands there were that would have been gathered together to hear the law? Now one would think that maybe God should have remembered that, this is going to be a big, big, big group here. We need to break them up into small groups. Well, sometimes they did. You know, when they were home, they did meet. Synagogues, assemblies, things like that. But they also came together. And when they came together, the law was read. So, you can read in the Bible and see that whether it was a lot or whether it was a little, whether it's a big group or a little group, and things like that, those things did not determine whether it was truly spiritual or not. when I've sat out here and I've heard you men, a lot of our men, get up here and make your comments before the Lord's Supper, I have found those comments to be as moving and as encouraging to the correct observance of the Lord's Supper as anywhere I've ever been. Very moving. Very moving in the right way. Not many services ago, do you remember, when we were in the grip of so much sickness and illness, do you remember that at that service we had men coming forward reading a scripture? We had other men coming forward leading songs that were chosen in connection with those scriptures. And we had men coming forward to lead prayers in connection with the scriptures and the songs and so on. We were worshiping God. We're worshiping God tonight. And that's what we're here for, to worship God. And we worship God when we study His Word. We worship God when we do His will because it is His will. That's worship. And that is worship in the broadest sense. That is offering to Him the sacrifice of our lives and our service when we do His will because it is His will. We are worshiping Him. And so whether we are praying to Him or singing praises to Him, studying His Word, whether we are observing the Lord's Supper, whether we are rendering unto Him our offerings of our money, we are worshiping Him. And let us rejoice that we have the relationship with Him. That's the thing to rejoice about. I hope that this lesson will help. I hope that it will just help to clarify some things and to give you some information that you need in order to be properly informed. If you're not a Christian tonight, and there are some here who are not, we plead with you to become a Christian by believing that Jesus is the Son of God, renouncing sin, turning away from it, confessing your faith, being buried with Christ through baptism to have your sins forgiven. By doing these things, you will be added to the family of God, to the body of Christ. If you are a child of God and you have been unfaithful, you wandered away from His service, we plead with you to return and come back and confess that which you have done, if it be of a public nature. Let us pray with you and for you to God. If you're